Shona Riddell is a Wellington writer known for children's books and histories. Trial of Strength was her chronicle of the Auckland Islands, the improbable attempts to settle them and live there, and the snares in Campbell Island. Shona's own great-grandmother was born on the Auckland Islands in 1851. Guiding Lights is her new history, the extraordinary lives of lighthouse women. And they have been extraordinary, as we'll discover, and women, as well as men, have always been attracted to the life.
I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and keep him company. I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and live by the side of the sea. I'll polish his lamp by the light of day so troops at night can find their way. I want to marry a lighthouse keeper, won't that be okay? We'll take walks along the moonlit bay, maybe find a treasure too. I'd love living in a lighthouse. I dream of living in a lighthouse, baby, every single day. I dream of living in a lighthouse, a white one by the bay. So if you want to make my dreams come true, be a lighthouse keeper, do. We could live in a lighthouse, a white one by the bay. Hey, won't that be okay?
Shona Riddell, the writer of Guiding Lights, is with us. Morning, Shona.
Good morning, Jim.
Possibly many of us have fantasised at times about living in a lighthouse. Did you ever?
Oh, yes. There's quite a romantic idea of lighthouses, isn't there? You know, living on the coast and just that freedom and being by the sea. It sounds kind of idyllic, but of course when you read the story, it wasn't all romance and loves.
No, there was some romance. We'll get to it. Why are you so interested in women in lighthouses? You've got lighthouse life in the family, don't you?
That's right. Well, I became interested when I learned the story of Mary Jane Bennett, who was the keeper of Pencarrow Lighthouse here in Wellington, which I can see from where I live here in Wellington. And so she was the lighthouse keeper at Pencarrow in the 1850s and 1860s for about 10 years, living there along with her children. And as I learned her story, it made me wonder if there were other women who were lighthouse keepers in New Zealand. There weren't. She was the only one. But around the world, there were many others. And so that took me on a journey around the world, learning about all these amazing women.
First lit in 1859, the Pencarrow light. Hasn't shone since when?
Since 1935.
Shame.
There was a lighthouse there. Well, before 1859, but it was more of a lantern in a tiny shack where the family lived, and it sounds like pretty tough conditions.
This is an international book, lighthouses, as you're saying, from around the world. In one way, lighthouses were always egalitarian sorts of places. In the US, there have been female keepers in sole charge of lighthouses since the 18th century, you write.
That's right. And that was one of the things that really surprised me, particularly in the early 1800s. There was a man called Stephen Pleasanton, who was the superintendent of lighthouses around the USA. And so he actively championed widows taking over their late husband's job as lighthouse keeper. If the husband passed away, then these women were appointed as principal keepers and put in charge of these lighthouses, sometimes for decades, living there with often many children as well in quite remote locations. So just their dedication and their, you know, toughness, because it wasn't an easy life. And remembering also that this was about 100 years before women had the vote in the US.
Yeah.
So it seems quite progressive, but as you read, it was more about convenience, you know, than trying to sort of actively empower women or break through glass ceilings. But it's still amazing. In the book, in Guiding Lights, there are stories of these women and how they became keepers and what their lives were like. And I just found it really inspiring.
And women got equal pay.
They got equal pay, sometimes even greater pay. In the case of Ida Lewis, who was one of America's most famous keepers, when she was finally appointed keeper later in her life, because she was a keeper's daughter to start with, she was the highest paid lighthouse keeper both genders in the USA.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And after all, a well-regulated woman takes pride in bright, well-kept things and orderly surroundings.
Yes, that's right, as they said in the past.
I'm quoting your book.
Yeah, that's right. There was a lot of cleaning involved for male and female keepers.
Women still are in charge of lighthouses, and one of the points made in your book is that women, sometimes with blokes attached, are still in charge of Australia's southernmost lighthouse. They do stints there. Why do they?
That's right. So they're caretakers. So one example is on Matsuika Island, which is part of Tasmania, and it's got Matsuika Lighthouse, which is Australia's southernmost lighthouse. So it's in quite a wild, remote location. And every 6 months, they rotate a couple, usually a married couple, as caretakers of this island. So part of their job is to look after the old lighthouse, which is now automated. But they're also wildlife caretakers and weather monitors. And so I interviewed a woman who last year was one of the caretakers there with her partner. Her name was Hannah Sutton. And it was just incredible. I talked to her twice when she first arrived in the island and just before she left. And so she was there for 6 months just with her partner, Grant. And they were there over winter, so not many visitors, as you can imagine. And they loved it. But, you know, it's pretty tough conditions, you know, strong winds and looking out towards Antarctica. Yeah, but she sent me the most amazing photos, which I've included in the book. Just really beautiful pictures.
Yeah, Hannah and Grant look very happy in those photos. There are lots of excellent photos right through your book. How many lighthouses do we have left in Aotearoa that have humans in them?
None. So yeah. We have active lighthouses. I think the number is 23 active lighthouses around New Zealand, as well as about 75 light beacons. But they've all been automated for about 30 years now.
But do humans go into them and do the maintenance and maybe check on a pretty regular basis or not?
Yeah, they're still looked after. Some of them as historic places and some of them, by Maritime New Zealand maintaining them, and they're still shining their lights, as you can see. But I was surprised to learn that Canada still has lighthouse keepers, and I interviewed a woman named Karen Zakaruk who lives on Vancouver Island for Cape Beale Lighthouse, and she lives on a nature reserve surrounded by cougars and wolves. And
I saw that.
Yeah, her life just sounds incredible.
It
so
does.
She's been in charge there for 10 years.
Tell us a bit of the tale of Pusiga Point, which was New Zealand's toughest lighthouse.
Yes, well, it was the toughest lighthouse for families because it was a family station. And so it's in part of Fiordland and pretty remote and blasted by freezing cold winds, and life there sounds like it was very challenging with chickens literally blown off the cliffs. It was so windy.
Yeah,
and the original lighthouse was burned down in the early 1940s by an arsonist who was institutionalised after that. But
That's an unbelievable story.
Yeah, there was a lot of drama there. So he lived on a nearby island, Coal Island, and apparently he took objection to the periodic sweep of light through his bedroom window and decided to just destroy the lighthouse. Took a keeper hostage and broke the radio system. And so, yeah, included in the book is this aerial photograph taken the next day of this lighthouse just smouldering. So there's a lighthouse there now, but it replaced the original.
Burned down the lighthouse because the light shone through his window.
Yeah.
And the initiation ceremony for relief keepers when they arrived at Pusiga Point.
That's right. So the southerly was so ferocious that apparently relief keepers, as part of an initiation, would stand on the edge of the cliff and spread out their oilskin raincoat and just sort of lean into the void. And apparently, you know, because the winds were so strong, you know, the weather measuring equipment would break. It was so brutal that they would sort of be, you know, kept standing on the cliff so they didn't fall off. But yeah, it does sound pretty dramatic.
You wouldn't get away with that today with health and safety,
no,
would you?
No, you wouldn't.
I shuddered when I read that. The thought of leaning into the void.
I don't know if I could do it.
No, and relying on the wind. Guiding lights go back thousands of years, Shona. There's a lot of elegant scholarship in your book, actually.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So I wasn't intending to start the book with Greek mythology, but that's sort of where the story of lighthouses began, because lighthouses started with bonfires on hilltops. That was the, you know, the guiding lights right at the beginning. So that's where I started.
The Pharos in Alexandria was the first actual lighthouse that we know of?
Yeah, that's right. So that was over 2,000 years ago, and it sounds like a pretty sophisticated structure for its time, and it burned for a long time. Some of them are, you know, centuries old, and they're withstanding tough conditions, but they're still standing.
There's such marvellous history and tradition. Speaking of tradition, ships don't use foghorns anymore. I gleaned that from your book.
That's right. So the history of foghorns, or, you know, sounds to warn mariners in thick fog, because, of course, if the fog was thick, you couldn't actually see the light shining. So that's how foghorns evolved. You know, they weren't always effective, and sometimes the poor lighthouse keepers, including women, you know, would have to manually just bang on a bell if the equipment broke down, which would have been pretty arduous.
Foghorns are a sound that have, you know, entered our consciousness, and probably most people can think of how they sound. It seems a shame they'll never be sounded again.
Well, you might still hear them. I think they're still used, but they're just not as necessary as they used to be.
So, these people across the centuries were isolated. They could be cut off for weeks or months at a time by the weather. You couldn't go down to the dairy and buy milk and pasta. Can you describe, because you do in the book, lighthouse layout, how lighthouses typically functioned as living spaces as well, Shona?
Yeah, well, it depended on the era and the country, but you can imagine these solitary keepers living in these wave-washed towers, and the supply deliveries, depending on where they were, could be quite sporadic at best. So they had to be really self-sufficient. And obviously, the more barren the area surrounding the lighthouse, the more difficult it was for keepers.
For women, giving birth by yourself sometimes, how frightening would that be? And medical treatment for whatever, maybe days away if something happened.
Yeah, well, I have children myself, so yeah, the idea sounds pretty scary to me. Obviously, as time changed, you know, helicopters were introduced and seaplanes and stuff, so women who were about to give birth could be taken from the lighthouse, you know, a month or so before delivery and give birth on the mainland. But before that, yeah, that's right, they were just giving birth at the lighthouses. And each lighthouse had a medical kit, which kind of boggles the mind when you read the list of the sort of historical medical kits.
Basic, was it?
Yeah. To put it mildly.
And the not inconsiderable aspect of risking your own life if the guiding light failed, or if there were people who needed rescuing in atrocious conditions in a small boat.
That's right. So obviously there were pretty dramatic stormy conditions at times, but the worse the weather was, the more important their job was. You know, they were saving lives by keeping this light burning, sometimes in incredibly difficult circumstances, you know, and getting up multiple times and staying up all night just to make sure that the light kept shining out to sea.
Ida Lewis, who you've mentioned, and Grace Darling. Grace Darling was famous, of course. They both risked their lives to save others, and more than a dozen portrait painters sailed to Grace's lighthouse to try and get her likeness, like a swarming of paparazzi today. She was a real celebrity, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. So this was in the 1830s in England. So she rowed out with her father to a shipwreck and rescued some of the survivors, and she was a young woman, you know, living in this solitary lighthouse. It was called Longstone Lighthouse. And yeah, as the story spread in the media, as you can imagine, this was before television, before radio, so people would literally visit the lighthouse. You know, they were dealing with all these visitors and painters who wanted to capture her likeness, and you know, people wanted locks of her hair, and she had marriage proposals, and it was all pretty crazy for someone who'd just grown up in lighthouses with her family and knew no other life, you know, and it all sounds incredibly stressful.
There was a Grace Darling chocolate bar from Cadbury's, but her story turned tragic. It's a real caveat around attaining sudden fame, her story.
That's right. So there were no PR companies in those times, and yeah, so she was just trying to take things as they came, and her whole family was, you know, people wanting her to give speeches and appear as a guest, you know, at their shows. And yeah, it all quickly took its toll on her health, and sadly she passed away at the age of 26, just a few years after this rescue. Yeah.
That's a very sad story, and I didn't know about Grace Darling's ending. Guiding Lights, The Extraordinary Lives of Lighthouse Women, and Shona Riddell is with us. Ida Lewis was remarkable too, like Grace Darling. Can you tell us about her bravery? But she never got thanked.
Oh, she did. She did get thanked. Yeah, a few times she was given medals for her bravery.
No, but by the people she rescued.
Oh, I see. Sorry, by the So Ida Lewis performed dozens of rescues in her lifetime. She was initially the daughter of a keeper at Lime Rock Lighthouse in Rhode Island in America, and she was very handy with a rowboat. So from a teenager, whenever young men would get into trouble near the lighthouse, she would row out by herself and fish them out of the water and bring them back. And, you know, she saved multiple lives that way. But the idea at the time of a woman, you know, rescuing men, I imagine these young men were quite embarrassed. Some of them were quite intoxicated at the time. And so she wasn't really thanked by the people she saved. Yeah. And it wasn't till her story was finally picked up by the media and then it spread worldwide. And then suddenly she was given accolades and attention similar to Grace Darling, that, you know, her name became more widely known and her bravery was acknowledged.
People are interesting when they're rescued. I did a TV profile once of George Johnston, who saved countless people capsizing on the bar on Thornton Beach, and he was seldom thanked. And I think once a bloke brought half a dozen beers back afterwards, but George wasn't home, and when he got home and there was one bottle left and the bloke had drunk the beer himself, as I recall the story.
Right. Yeah, it was part of the job really to save people's lives when you're a lighthouse keeper.
Yeah.
You know, if you saw someone in trouble, you were expected to go and help them.
We see lighthouses, and this is a point made in the publicity for the book, as both comforting and romantic beacons symbolising hope and trust, but also as storm-lashed and forbidding towers with echoes of lonely souls, which is well put. It's a strange dichotomy. Which side of it do you come down on?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, when I look out to see them at sea, I'm definitely comforted by them because they're a universal symbol regardless of which country you're from or how old you are. Everyone knows what a lighthouse is, and they were built to help everybody. But at the same time, I've done all this research and I know of the history, and it wasn't always light and comforting.
No.
So as you say, that dichotomy is very interesting.
Yes, you've got great accounts of tragedy and wretchedness, but also the life thoroughly suited some people and some families, and they missed it a lot when they left.
That's right. So I've talked to people who were lighthouse keepers because, as I mentioned, New Zealand lighthouses were still being staffed until 30 years ago. So it's possible to still talk to people who grew up in lighthouses. And, if you were suited for the life and you enjoyed it, then it sounds pretty idyllic, you know, especially if you were growing up there, you had freedom and you were given practical life skills, which not all of us get these days. You know, it was a good life for a lot of people, and people would stay in the service for decades.
So you've got a bit of it in your genes. Do you think you would be suited to that life? Could you have hacked it?
Good question. It depends on the era and the lighthouse, just with that caveat. I think if it wasn't too isolated and it wasn't too many years ago, I think I would have enjoyed it. But maybe not 200 years ago in the middle of nowhere, I think I would have found that pretty tricky.
There was romance, as we hinted at before, and forbidden love. Larry Butler in Ireland courted his future wife by semaphore. Another lighthouse keeper's daughter eloped by small boat to be with her paramour.
Yes, that's right. So keepers and their families were taught the semaphore flag signals to communicate with ships offshore. And as you said, there are some stories of people communicating in a romantic way and eventually eloping. And there was a story I really loved in Australia, Western Australia, on Breaksea Island. There was a teenage girl called Faye Catherine Howe, who was the lightkeeper's daughter, and she was there at the onset of World War One as all the Anzac ships were sailing from Western Australia off to war. And so she was communicating with the soldiers, and they were, you know, throwing messages and bottles back over to her, and some of them wrote to her from the front, which I thought was quite a poignant story because not all of them would have come home.
Giving diggers a last chance to send a message home. That's very bittersweet now, that memory, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Brian Rees at the Ministry of Transport, a man who saw no romance in the lighthouse life, and he became highly unpopular. Why?
Because he was responsible for the de-staffing of New Zealand lighthouses in the late 80s. Yeah, so from what I've read and the people I've spoken to, it was all handled pretty harshly. And a lot of the keepers' accommodation was destroyed at the time, which is a real shame because it means that we've lost that part of the history. Because the lighthouse stations were not just the towers, they were also the homes of the keepers, and there were often, you know, several keepers and families there to support each other and to share the duties. So, yeah, it sounds like a really rough time for those who were keepers at the time who, you know, had given decades of their lives and it was their home to have to suddenly move out and find a whole new profession.
The busted headlight in Queensland was plain unlucky. Why?
Well, some people call it a lighthouse of horrors just because it has a rather cursed history. From when it was built, people just seemed to die who were associated with it, from the people who were building it to the keepers to members of their families. There were, you know, kidnappings, suicides, you know, terrible accidents and disappearances. So I think the old tower sits there more peacefully now today. But yeah, when you read through the list of, you know, events that occurred since it was constructed, it seems unluckier than most.
You didn't want to be posted to the busted headlight.
Exactly.
And the phantom piano music of the Seguin light in the Gulf of Maine, shades of the movie The Shining.
It is, yes. It's definitely something I thought of when I read that story. So, well, there was rumoured to be a keeper and his wife living there in the 1800s, and the keeper's wife was apparently lonely, living on this isolated island, and so to help, the keeper had this piano delivered to help entertain her, which would have been logistically quite challenging, I imagine, getting a piano there. And
up the stairs.
And up the stairs, up the cliff, and apparently she only knew one tune and she played it over and over and over, and that grated on his nerves, and so he attacked the piano with an axe, and then she received the same treatment, and then he took his own life. This is one of the this is in the myths and legends chapter of the book, and even today when people sail past this island, they can still hear the faint piano music even though there's no piano.
They can hear the tinkling over the water.
That's right.
Wonder what that piece of music was. The Isle of Passion, Clipperton Island, somewhere in the Pacific. I'd never heard of it. And it's Reign of Terror. What a tale this is.
Yes, it's a pretty incredible story for such an isolated atoll, which is off the southwest coast of Mexico. And for such a tiny island with nothing on it, for years it was contested between Mexico and the US, Britain and France, all wanting ownership because it had the valuable guano, which is, you know, the
bird droppings.
Yeah, the bird droppings as fertilizer. And for a while there was a Mexican settlement there. A lot of the settlers died off of scurvy, their supply. It's a pretty sad story. Their supply boat stopped coming from the Mexican mainland. And so one by one they died off until there were only about a dozen people left. And then the lighthouse keeper, who had been pretty reclusive, suddenly took over and was murdering and raping the poor women who were left, until one of the women killed him. And not long after that, this is early 20th century, a US ship arrived, which was on the hunt for German U-boats during World War I, came across these settlers on the island. People hadn't realised they were even there, and rescued them. So the woman and children who were left survived and were taken back to Mexico.
It's remarkable. This is almost living memory, isn't it? And it's remarkable that that could have happened.
Yeah.
And the ghostly girls of St. Augustine, where the lighthouse is now a paranormal sort of shrine.
Yes, that's right. So that's a huge draw card for tourists. This American lighthouse, which is believed to be haunted by the ghosts of these girls who were in an accident when the latest lighthouse was being built, because there have been a few lighthouses there. So there are similar stories, especially in the US, I've noticed, where, you know, there are believed to be haunted lighthouse, and paranormal investigators go there, and many fascinating stories.
Long may their lights shine is just about the last thing you write in this book. Will the lights keep shining?
I hope so, as long as there are people around to care for them, and it seems like there are. There are many lighthouse societies around the world, and maritime organisations where people are actively trying to maintain the old towers and share their history, which is really wonderful.
What's your favourite lighthouse of all?
Well, it would have to be Pencarrow, because that's the one I see almost every day, and it's got such a great story associated with it.
I didn't ask you much about the Pencarrow. What really do you like about Pencarrow Lighthouse?
Well, so Mary Bennett's story was that she came from England and she had quite a wealthy background. Her father was a squire in Yorkshire, and she met a tradesman there called George Bennett, and they obviously took a liking to each other. George proposed, her father said no, presumably because of the class difference. But then Mary and George both sailed to New Zealand on separate ships and got married over here. And George Bennett was actually the first lighthouse keeper in New Zealand, and so they lived together at Pencarrow with their growing family. But sadly, in 1855, George was drowned in a boat accident, leaving Mary alone with five children and pregnant with their sixth. And so she took over the lighthouse, and she ran it for 10 years, apparently did a very good job, and then returned to England with her children. But interestingly, all three of her sons returned to New Zealand just a few years later, so they obviously loved the light, and her youngest son, William, took over as assistant keeper at Pencarrow. So there were several generations of Bennetts there.
It's a very satisfying story. You could do lighthouse tours.
I could.
Hey, thanks for coming in this morning. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Jim.
Shona Waddell.